Hi, class. This is your professor, Dr. Fields. We are continuing our lecture series here for the second third of the course. This is going to cover this lecture and the next one. Both are going to cover neurodevelopmental disorders. So it's a two-part lecture, just like with the addictive disorders. First off, I just want to commend all of you who are keeping up with the lectures. That's just something I want to make note of here, that I do realize in this very difficult time period that we're in right now, I am very appreciative of those of you who are keeping up with the lectures in a timely fashion. That is greatly appreciated. For those of you who are not, I would suggest getting a move on because our exam is scheduled for Monday, April 6th. So that gives you just a little bit over a week to get all the lectures completed by then. Okay, so get cracking if you haven't already. So neurodevelopmental disorders is going to cover chapter 14, or rather, chapter 14 is going to pertain to our two lectures on neurodevelopmental disorders. There is one disorder I'm adding to this that the chapter doesn't really go into in any kind of depth, which is Tourette's syndrome. I think it's important to review that one as well. And after this and the next part of this lecture, we will have done all of the lectures for exam number two. Okay? All right. So, as always, whenever we start off a new lecture, I always put up a few YouTube videos that I felt were pretty good in highlighting some of the different disorders. So, go ahead and take a look at them, which are going to be contained on slide number one, and then come back to the lecture. Okay, so I'm assuming you saw the videos. We're now going to start going over the DSM-5 diagnostic criteria for the various disorders. We're going to start off with one of the more common ones. Which is really a very common one to everyone, even outside of the psychology profession. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So, the first thing I should mention about this disorder is that there are really essentially three types. So you can have ADHD, which manifests predominantly in attentional difficulties, or ADHD, which manifests predominantly in hyperactive impulsive symptoms, or the third type is the combination type, which tends to be the most common. Okay, so let's just take a look at some of these criteria here. We're talking about a persistent pattern of inattention and/or hyperactivity, impulsivity that interferes with functioning or development, as characterized by one and/or two. So we have essentially two subsets of criteria, one for inattention, that involves six or more of the following symptoms that have to have persisted for at least 6 months to a degree that is inconsistent with the developmental level and that negatively impacts directly on social and academic or occupational functioning. There's our catchphrase that we see all the time with these different disorders, whether it be, implied or overtly referred to. Special note here, the symptoms are not solely a manifestation of oppositional behavior, defiance, hostility, or failure to understand tasks or instructions. Now, if you have oppositional defiant disorder, you can also have ADHD, but what they're saying is that these symptoms are not solely due to oppositional behavior, okay? For older adolescents and adults ages 17 and older, then you only need 5 of these symptoms to meet the criteria. Okay? All right, so let's look at some of these symptoms. Failure to give close attention to details or making careless mistakes in schoolwork, at work, or during other activities. Often has difficulty sustaining attention in tasks or play activities. Often does not seem to listen when spoken to directly. And of course, this does not have to do with a hearing impairment or something of that nature. Often does not follow through on instructions and fails to finish schoolwork, chores, or duties in the workplace. Often has difficulty organizing tasks and activities. Often avoids, dislikes, or is reluctant to engage in tasks that require sustained mental effort. Often loses things necessary for tasks or activities. Is often easily distracted by extraneous stimuli. For older adolescents and adults, this could simply be unrelated thoughts. So that it's more, observable in children. It may not be as observable in adults unless you're, asking them directly in an interview. Is often forgetful in daily activities. So, we're really talking about a difficulty here, sustaining attention, which leads to forgetfulness, which leads to difficulties staying organized, staying on task, etc., etc. Okay? For hyperactivity and impulsivity, that subtype, 6 or more of the following symptoms must have persisted for at least 6 months to a degree, again, that is inconsistent with developmental level and that negatively impacts directly on social, academic, or occupational activities. Note the symptoms are not solely a manifestation of oppositional behavior, defiance, hostility, or a failure to understand tasks or instructions. We might see that in somebody with an intellectual disability. And for older adolescents and adults ages 17 or older, again, at least 5 symptoms are required. So these symptoms include fidgeting with or tapping hands or feet or squirming in seat, often leaving seat in situations when remaining seated is appropriate. Or expected, rather. Often runs about or climbs in situations where it is inappropriate. For adolescents and adults, this may be limited to just restless feelings. Often unable to play or engage in leisure activities quietly, is often on the go, acting as if driven by a motor. Often blurts out an answer before a question has been completed. Talks excessively, has difficulty waiting his or her turn, and often interrupts or intrudes on others. So these symptoms really have to do with, just as they say, hyperactivity, fidgetiness, and impulsivity. And really has to do with difficulties controlling those behavioral aspects. Okay? Criterion B, several inattentive or hyperactive impulsive symptoms need to be present prior to 12 years of age. Several inattentive or hyperactive impulsive symptoms are present in 2 or more settings. So, in other words, they have to be displayed in at least 2 settings, such as home and school for children or home and work for adults. There is clear evidence that the symptoms interfere with or reduce the quality of social, academic, or occupational functioning. There's a catchphrase again. And then the rule out. The symptoms do not occur exclusively during the course of other kinds of mental conditions. And then we have a variety of specifiers. The ones that I think are most important for our purposes is knowing that there is a predominantly inattentive presentation where criterion A has to be, A1 has to be met, the inattentive criteria. Or predominantly hyperactive impulsive presentation where criterion A2, those symptoms pertaining to hyperactivity impulsivity, needs to be met. And then, of course, for the combined presentations, both of criterion A1 and A2 need to be met. Okay, and that's the most common one. Okay, moving on. Specific learning disorder. This has to do with difficulties learning and using academic skills, as indicated by the presence of at least one of the following symptoms that have persisted for at least 6 months, despite the provision of interventions that target those difficulties. So, in other words, it's not enough just to have some academic difficulties or some skill weaknesses. They need to persist even after remediation has taken place. Okay? So, what kinds of academic difficulties do we see with children with specific learning disorder and adults? Inaccurate or slow and effortful word reading, difficulty understanding the meaning of what is read, having to do with reading comprehension, difficulties with spelling, difficulties with written expression in terms of, how they express themselves in writing, difficulties mastering number sense, number facts, or calculation. Okay, examples are like has poor understanding of numbers, their magnitude, and relationships. Difficulties with mathematical reasoning, has severe difficulty applying mathematics concepts, facts, or procedures to solve quantitative problems. The affected academic skills are substantially and quantifiably below those expected for the individual's chronological age, and, there's our catchphrase, cause significant interference with academic or occupational performance. And of course, indirectly, they can certainly affect their social performance as well. If a child's self-esteem is affected, and that generalizes to the social situation where they don't feel competent socially, or with activities of daily living, could interfere with that as well. When they say quantifiably, that has to, I mean, whenever we're talking about quantity, right? We're talking about amounts. And that has to do with numbers, math, right? So what they're talking about with the term quantifiably below, it means that, these skills have been measured by a test and have been found to yield to a certain degree that is well below their peers. In other words, they are very much below average in these academic skills, whether they be for reading, writing, or math. Those are the main academic skills that we're looking at with specific learning disorder, because they really apply to all academic subjects, right? I mean, if you're talking about learning literature or science or global studies or whatever it is that you're learning, accounting, they all involve one or more of these fundamental basic academic skills. Okay? Criterion C, the learning difficulties must begin during school age years, but may not become fully manifest until the demands for those affected academic skills exceed the individual's limited capacities. And the learning difficulties are not better accounted for other kinds of DSM-5 disorders. There's our rule out. Note, the four diagnostic criteria are to be met, meaning criteria A through D, on a clinical synthesis of the individual's history that will include their developmental, medical, family, and educational backgrounds, school reports, and psychoeducational assessment. That is what determines where they are relative to their peers, and has to do with, proving that they are quantifiably below those that are below their peers. Okay. Specify all academic domains and subskills that are impaired. When more than one domain is impaired, each one should be recorded individually according to the following specifiers. So, essentially we're talking about being more specific, and it's in the title, right? Specific learning disorder, in terms of what their skill deficits are. Are they related to reading or writing or math? And if so, what particular areas? So it is a specific learning disorder, okay? Now, what is a more pervasive kind of disorder, which you could look at as some kind of learning disorder, right, is a language disorder. So we're going to now be moving on to the next slide. It's more pervasive because when you're talking about learning disorders, you're talking about, information in the written form that you're having difficulty with, whether it be mathematical calculations, sentences that you're forming, sentences that you're reading, this is all within the written form. A language disorder affects two modes of communication, not just the written form, but the spoken form, so that these individuals have difficulty processing and comprehending or understanding spoken language as well as written language. Okay? More specifically, if we're looking at the criteria, it involves persistent difficulties in the acquisition and use of language across modalities, spoken, written, and can even include sign language for those individuals who are deaf. So a deaf person could have a language disorder if they have more difficulty learning sign language than other deaf people. Okay? So persistent difficulties in the acquisition and use of language across modalities due to deficits in comprehension or production that include the following: reduced vocabulary, word knowledge and use, limited sentence structure, ability, which is the ability to put words and word endings together to form sentences based on the rules of grammar and morphology. Grammar refers to, the rules within a language of how you're supposed to put words together. In the written form, and morphology is basically grammar in the spoken form. Okay, so how you're supposed to put words together in the spoken form, which really shouldn't differ. It just means that morphology connotates the spoken form, and grammar has to do with the written form. And this can also involve impairments in discourse, which is the ability to use vocabulary and connect sentences to explain or describe a topic or series of events or have a conversation. Now, I want to go back up to that first sentence for criterion A. Towards the end of that sentence, it says, due to deficits in comprehension or production. Language comprehension is referred to as receptive language. It's, basically the analog of reading comprehension, but in the spoken form. But can also include the written form. So it really encompasses both. When we talk about receptive language, we're talking about the person's ability to understand language, spoken or written. Production is known as expressive language, and that can involve, again, both the written and spoken forms of language. So I would argue that this is a more global impairment than a specific learning disorder in that it affects both the spoken and written forms of language, which can make it extremely hard to learn. Because not only are you having difficulty learning from the textbook, or learning from the chalkboard, but you're also having difficulty learning when the teacher is lecturing or just speaking to the class in general and trying to explain a concept. Okay, criterion B, language abilities are substantially and quantifiably below those expected for age, resulting in functional limitations in effective communication, social participation, academic achievement, or occupational performance. So, basically, if you're having a deficit or if you have deficient communication, that is going to affect your social functioning, your academic functioning, your occupational functioning, etc., etc. So there's our catchphrase there. All right. And quantifiably again, how do we determine this? By tests, by psychoeducational tests that test a student's or child's language acquisition skills or language development and compares their skills to their peers. So if these skills are substantially below their peers, again, if they have received, remedial services and they're still found to be below their peers, that is evidence of a language disorder. Criterion C, the onset of symptoms is in the early developmental period. And D is our rule out. They are not attributable, sorry, to these other kinds of psychological or neurological impairments. Okay. All right. So moving on from less to more in terms of the academic impact. You have a specific learning disorder, and actually, you could even look at, well, I guess depending on how severe ADHD could be, it could certainly have a very substantial impact on academic achievement, more indirectly, right? But then, you're talking about a learning disorder having a more direct impact on educational achievement, and then I would argue a language disorder having even more of an impact, and then intellectual disability having the greatest impact. And when we're talking about intellectual disability, this is a newer term in the DSM-5. It used to be called mental retardation. And unfortunately, certain labels, in the way that they're used, start to have a real negative connotation. Okay? So, when ignorant people are referring to others that they think are not smart as retards, that then starts to affect people's perception of this term, right? That has that word in it, inherent in it, right? Retardation. And so therefore, it's almost like we have to like start anew and say, this word has gotten a really bad rap, so to speak. It's been used in a very derogatory manner, so we're going to use a softer term, intellectual disability. So that's what we're using now, which does not have the same kind of negative stigma from ignorant people using it in a derogatory manner. Of course, that could change. Okay, so intellectual disability, also known as an intellectual developmental disorder, is a disorder that occurs during the developmental period or during childhood that includes deficits in both I'm sorry, intellectual and adaptive functioning. Okay? And adaptive functioning deficits can be in the domains of social or more practical kinds of areas like independent living skills or communication, etc., etc., etc. And I will explain what that means in just a second. The following three criteria must all be met: deficits in intellectual functions, which could involve reasoning, problem solving, planning, abstract thinking, judgment, academic learning, learning from experience, which is confirmed by both clinical assessment and in individualized standardized intelligence testing. So, one of the ways we diagnose intellectual disability is by administering an intelligence test. And, just like with language disorder and specific learning disorder, we are looking for, quantifiable information, information that shows by way of statistics or mathematical calculations, for lack of a better way of saying it, that their intellectual functioning is below their peers, significantly below their peers. And if you want to know statistically what that means to be below one's peers, you can go way back when in your notes to when we talked about the bell curve. And the bell curve is a statistical distribution that shows, what we're talking about mathematically when we're referring to significantly below one's peers. Okay. Intellectual disability also must involve deficits in adaptive functioning that result in failure to meet developmental and sociocultural standards for personal independence and social responsibility. That really defines adaptive functioning or adaptive behavior, okay? When we're talking about adaptive behavior, this is behavior that a lot of us take for granted that is necessary for self-care and independent functioning, which could also involve being able to effectively communicate with others in whatever mode possible to get our needs met. Okay? So, being able to get our needs met, being able to take care of our needs, our social needs, our independent living needs, etc., etc. Okay? Without ongoing support, the adaptive deficits limit functioning in one or more activities of daily life, such as communication, social participation, and independent living across multiple environments, such as home, school, work, and community. An intellectual disability is a global kind of disability. It affects all areas of learning, in and out of the classroom, and all areas of functioning in and out of the classroom. The best way to look at the difference between intelligence and adaptive behavior is intelligence is, what you are able to learn to do, okay? And adaptive functioning is what you actually do. So, in other words, you may know that you should brush your teeth every day because it's good dental hygiene. But if you don't do that every day, if you neglect doing that, that would be, a specific kind of adaptive behavior deficit. Okay? You may know that you should be showering every day, but if you don't do it every day, that's a problem. So, that's a real difference between intelligence. Intelligence has to do what you're able to do, what you can do, what you potentially can learn. And adaptive functioning is really what you're actually doing. And, in a sense, showing that learning that, yeah, I've learned that there are certain things I need to do in life, and that's what I'm doing, okay? To take care of myself, to be able to function more independently, etc., etc. So it really involves both of those areas. Okay? All right, last one. Oh no, I'm sorry. Second to last one. Sorry to get your hopes up. Autism spectrum disorder. Now, this umbrella term used to be called pervasive developmental disability. And then within that umbrella term were more specific kinds of autism-related disorders, such as autism and also Asperger's disorder. We no longer refer to Asperger's disorder, in that term. It's now included along with all autism-related disorders under this broad term of autism spectrum disorder. Okay, so that term is kind of outdated now, Asperger's. It's included within these criteria. And really, the way that we looked at the difference between Asperger's and autism was simply that autism was a much more severe form, and Asperger's was not as severe of a form of the disorder. That Asperger's had more impairment just in social communication and also presented with some of these ritualistic, repetitive behavior patterns, and autism also had a substantial impact on general communication and more areas of life functioning. But now we just look at a person in terms of their degree of these symptoms within this spectrum called autism spectrum disorder. Okay, so the first set of criteria, criterion A. Persistent deficits in social communication and social interaction across multiple contexts as manifested by the following, currently or by history. Deficits in social emotional reciprocity, ranging, for example, from abnormal social approach and failure of normal back and forth conversation. We call that reciprocal conversation. To reduce sharing of interests, emotions, or affect, to failure to initiate or respond to social interactions. Deficits in nonverbal communicative behaviors used for social interaction, ranging, for example, from poorly integrated verbal and nonverbal communication, to abnormalities in eye contact and body language, or deficits in understanding and use of gestures. To a total lack of facial expression and nonverbal communication. So they have difficulty understanding gestures, they have difficulty understanding the nuances of the more subtle nuances of conversation, such as sarcasm, etc., etc. Deficits in developing, maintaining, and understanding relationships, ranging, for example, from difficulties adjusting behavior to suit various social contexts, to difficulties in sharing imaginative play or in making friends, to absence of interest in peers. So, this disorder has a very negative impact on social functioning, and really, for lack of a better way of saying it, involves difficulties with social comprehension, understanding the social context, understanding people's intentions, understanding the communication of others, and then in turn having difficulties communicating themselves with others. Going to skip down to criterion B, restricted repetitive pattern of behavior or interests or activities as manifested by at least two of the following, currently or by history. Stereotyped or repetitive motor movements that could involve hand flapping, that is very common to children with autism. Use of objects or speech. Examples include simple motor stereotypies like hand flapping, lining up toys or flipping objects, echolalia, which is repeating speech over and over, and idiosyncratic phrases. Insistence on sameness and flexible adherence to routines or ritualized patterns of verbal or nonverbal behavior. Extreme distress at small changes, difficulties with transitions, rigid thinking patterns, greeting rituals, need to take the same route or eat the same food every day if we're talking about adults. So that, if you look at this, it sounds almost like obsessive compulsive disorder in terms of the compulsions, right? So you can almost look at this as, people with OCD have, engaged in these kind of ritualistic behaviors and what have you, and these related obsessional thoughts that a lot of them keep to themselves. But people with autism do not keep them to themselves. People can observe their obsessional thinking and their, rigid compulsive behaviors. And they're really quite repetitive, just like what we would see in somebody with obsessive compulsive disorder, but more as a function of this developmental disorder known as autism. Okay? And then it also can involve hyper or hypoactivity to sensory input. So, or unusual interest in sensory aspects of the environment. So, what does that mean? So, they have difficulties with regulation. So, either they can be very picky eaters and only like certain kinds of textures and be very aversive to touch, or physical affection, or they can be the opposite. Where, they're constantly hugging you and wanting to be close to you and, really not good at maintaining personal boundaries. I recently tested a girl with autism in high school and she constantly wanted to hug me. So it really could be, at either end of the spectrum, no pun intended, in terms of a real aversion to physical intimacy and touch, to the complete opposite. The ones that are very picky eaters that don't like to be touched a lot, they also can be very averse to, certain kinds of tactile sensations. Like a lot of them don't like to wear jeans that have that kind of autism because, they feel too restricted or they feel it's too uncomfortable. They don't like certain fabrics, etc., etc. Okay, criterion C, symptoms must be present in the early developmental period, but they may not become fully manifest until social demands exceed limited capacities. Symptoms cause clinically significant impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of current functioning, such as academics. There's our catchphrase, and our rule out in E that they are not due to an intellectual disability or other kinds of impairments. Now, you can have an intellectual disability and also have autism. Okay, that is possible. But the autistic related behaviors cannot solely be due to the intellectual disability. Okay, they have to be above and beyond what you would expect for that. Okay, now we're up to the last one. This one is not in our book. It's referenced in a table. And in passing, but it's not really reviewed. I want to review it because I think it's another important disorder in the neurodevelopmental disorders category. It's known as Tourette's disorder or Tourette's syndrome. This basically involves motor tics, and what a tic is it is a sudden, rapid, recurrent, non-rhythmic motor movement or vocalization. Okay? So, in other words, it could be as subtle as somebody just rolling their eyes, and they're not doing this intentionally. Okay? So, it could be a little eye roll. I once knew when I was growing up this kid that used to kind of jerk his head a little bit to the left. Every so often, and that was his kind of tick. And then it could be very pronounced, where it's like a full body kind of movement, or a very exaggerated kind of facial or head movement. And it could also involve vocalizations, which also are, a kind of motor movement, right? Involving the vocal cords and everything else that's involved of speech production. So that could be as simple as somebody just going, there's this guy at the gym who does it all the time. I'm convinced he's got, some kind of tic disorder. But he'll do it under, in a very subtle way where he'll just every now and then go, ooh, ooh, ooh. And that's all I hear in the locker room. So it could be as subtle as that. Or it could be something more pronounced, like some kind of barking almost, like, oh, okay. Or this type is very rare, but of course, it's very popular in the Hollywood movies where somebody's actually uttering a word over and over, which could be a curse word. And it's very loud. They'll be talking and they'll just be, going on and then shit. Hollywood likes to make that, seem like it's extremely common in Tourette's disorder when in fact it's very rare. What's more common are these more subtle kinds of tics. Okay? So Tourette's disorder then involve both multiple motor and one or more vocal tics. And again, a vocal tic being a more specific kind of motor tic, that have been present at some time during the illness, although not necessarily concurrently. Okay, the tics may wax and wane in frequency, but have persisted for more than 1 year since first tic onset, and onset has to happen before age 18. Age 18. And then there's our rule out. The disturbance is not attributable to the physiological effects of a substance like cocaine or another medical condition such as Huntington's disease that also could cause these kind of tics. Okay? So that if, a person is ticking because of, a substance or medical condition, that is not Tourette's disorder. Okay? That's due to something else. All right. Now, it doesn't list this as a criterion, but it's implied. This absolutely is going to have an impact on one's life functioning. Could definitely have a significant impact on their social functioning. They're very embarrassed about their tics, and so they kind of limit their socialization, or it limits their choice of occupation if they feel embarrassed by them. And it can also impact them academically or occupationally, in terms of their ability to concentrate. It's very difficult to concentrate when you're constantly doing these motor and vocal tics. Okay? Especially for something that involves sustained concentration like reading. All right, going on to the next slide, and this is slide 8. We're going to talk about the prevalence rates for some of these neurodevelopmental disorders. For attention hyperactivity disorder, which I'll refer to just as ADHD, the lifetime rate worldwide, okay, so I will specify if it's a statistic that implies its worldwide rate rather than just in the United States. So the worldwide prevalence rate for lifetime is 5 to 7%. It is estimated to be 2 to 3 times more prevalent in boys than girls, but this may be due to bias, so that people expect boys to have more behavioral problems. I almost thought that was odd because I almost kind of look at it like the opposite, it's normal to expect boys to kind of misbehave, and so therefore it would be overdiagnosed in girls, I would think. But anyway, that's what the experts say, so we'll follow them. For specific learning disorder, the lifetime prevalence rate worldwide is between 5 to 15%. The rate is more than double for blacks and whites, but this is likely due to bias. Okay. Specifically with some of the tests that we have, which have been known to have some bias inherent in them, unfortunately. They're not perfect measures. And reading disability is the most common subtype for learning disorder. Language disorder, 10 to 15% of children under 3, they didn't distinguish whether or not this is worldwide or just in the United States. Boys have a 5 times higher rate than girls. That to me was astounding. For autism spectrum disorder, it's estimated to be in 1 out of every 68 8-year-olds. That's pretty rare. And it occurs 4 to 5 times more in boys than girls. Again, I find these rates astounding, these gender differences. 30% of children with autism spectrum disorder have IQs less than 70. That's 2 standard deviations or more below the mean, which let's just say is very, very low. So that means, if we're looking at the bell curve, that, less than 5% of the population about has an IQ less than 70. Okay, so that's a very low IQ. Okay, going on to slide 9. All of these disorders are believed to have neurological or biological bases. So, in other words, psychological factors can exacerbate or worsen these conditions, absolutely, but they are all primarily believed to have neurological or biological bases. And I don't know if you caught on to this when we were going through all the different criteria, but all of these present first in childhood and can significantly directly impact academic functioning, right? Conditions like learning disorder and language disorder and intellectual disability and autism spectrum disorder can have significant impacts on academic functioning and social functioning as well, especially autism spectrum disorder. Okay. Now, there are some students who have high functioning autism spectrum disorder. That means they don't have low IQs. In fact, I tested a student not too long ago with autism spectrum disorder who had an IQ over 140. That pertains to the 99.9 percentile, which means he is smarter than 99.9% of his peers. So you can have autism with an extremely high IQ, for sure. But it can still affect his academic functioning because his rigidity in his routines and everything else can sometimes place him at conflicts with teachers and can cause frustrations and meltdowns to the point where, he doesn't want to do his work or, things like that. So it can still have an impact on his academic functioning. And they can have the potential, certainly, at the very least, to impact academic functioning, as can be seen in Tourette's disorder. People with Tourette's disorder, just like people with ADHD, have a lot of concentration difficulties for different reasons, because people with Tourette's disorder are distracted by their tics, and people with ADHD are distracted by external stimuli. And that certainly can impact academic performance. So all these disorders are going to be first present in childhood. You're not going to get this kind of disorder in adulthood unless it's due to traumatic brain injury. You got into some kind of serious accident that affected your neurological functioning, that left you with some kind of brain damage, for lack of a better way of saying it. And then what we're talking about there is something very different. We're talking about traumatic brain injury, right? So these are all present in childhood, and they all can have a very substantial impact on academic functioning. Now, psychologists' roles with these disorders involve accurately assessing and identifying the presence of these disorders and their impact on functioning, and aiming to reduce any related negative behaviors that are associated with many of these disorders, as well as helping these children increase positive pro-social behaviors. So really, you know, working with the negative effects of these kinds of disorders, particularly on behavioral functioning and social functioning. School psychologists, more specifically, as you know, I am a licensed psychologist. That means, you know, I have my own private practice and I see patients, but I'm also a school psychologist. I work in a high school. So school psychologists, more specifically, also determine whether or not children with these disorders meet the criteria for special education services, and if so, are key in trying to ascertain school-based support for these children. So we really are, our role has a lot to do with these children and trying to get them help, okay? All right, as I said, this is a two-part lecture. So we're only going to go through a few more slides and then we're going to stop for today. This lecture is going to be due this Monday, this upcoming Monday, which is, I believe, March 30th. And then part two of this lecture will be due that Thursday, which I believe is April 2nd. Okay? All right, let's talk about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So causes, genes are strongly related to the risk for developing this disorder. It's looked upon as a biological or neurological disorder, like all of these neurodevelopmental disorders. Changes in brain functioning, especially in the frontal lobe, which we know has to do with self-control, impulse control, directing attention, directing behavior. This is, you know, where executive functioning exists. You know, if you kind of think of like an executive in a business is somebody that gives orders and, you know, tells people what to do. They direct people. Well, the frontal lobe directs our behavior in terms of directing our attention, or in terms of telling us to not do something. In other words, you know, somebody's speaking and the frontal lobe says, don't talk right now, don't interrupt them, right? Or, you know, focus on this person right now. So in people with ADHD, there are there's abnormal functioning in the frontal lobe, which we would expect because they are not good at doing those things. There are also neurotransmitter imbalances that have been related to this disorder, particularly involving dopamine. There's also been some evidence that prenatal exposure to toxins, particularly maternal smoking, could have an impact on the development of this disorder. While this is largely considered a neurological or biological condition, family discord and poor parenting practices can exacerbate this disorder and, of course, lead to other negative psychological effects, okay? So if you have good, consistent parenting, you know, that could help mediate some of the negative impact of this disorder. Makes sense, right? Okay, going on to slide 11, treatments for this disorder. Notice we didn't talk much or any about, you know, real psychological causes of this disorder because it's considered a biological disorder, neurological one, okay? All right, slide 11, medical treatments for this disorder. No surprise, I'm sure you guys are all well aware of this, stimulant medication. So what do we have here? Amphetamine, dextroamphetamine combination, which is known as Adderall. I know a lot of you in college abuse that. That's a no-no. You shouldn't be doing that. Methylphenidate, Ritalin, and Concerta. Ritalin was one of the first medications developed for ADHD. Lisdexamfetamine, which is known as Vyvanse. dexmethylphenidate, which is known as Focalin, and there are some others that exist out there, some newer ones as well. Non-stimulant medication can also help with the symptoms of ADHD. I'm sorry. Some of these are not easy to pronounce, folks. Atomoxetine, I think that's the best I'm going to do on that. Strattera, that affects neurotransmitter balance, because we know that there seems to be an imbalance, especially with dopamine. And clonidine, the brand name known as Catapress, which is primarily used to lower blood pressure. Okay? So these all are trying to target these hyperactive, inattentive symptoms. And, you know, it's always counterintuitive to a lot of people that, you know, these kids often are very hyperactive. What the heck do we want to give them stimulant medication? That's, you know, we look at stimulant medication like speed, you know, it speeds us up. Why would we want to do that? Well, because, and this is something that's important for me to point out to all of you, you know, ADHD, you know, or children with ADHD, a lot of times are thought to have problems with attention. But really, the problem can be better viewed as difficulties from paying attention to everything. You know, they are very distractible. They hear a little noise, they're focused on that. Then they're looking over here, then they're looking over there. They don't have a difficulty paying attention in general. The problem is that they pay attention to everything, and so therefore, it makes it very difficult for them to pay attention to one thing. Okay? The understanding that we have is that these children are understimulated. They get bored easily. You know, we know when they're doing activities they really love, like video games, they're super focused. So they get bored very easily. They need more stimulation or they will get bored. So ironically, you know, or counterintuitively, giving them stimulant medication works because when they are more stimulated, it's kind of like, ah, oh, I got the stimulation I needed. Now I feel fine. I feel good. I don't feel as bored and therefore I can focus. Okay? All right, this is going to be the last slide for this lecture. Psychological interventions. We cannot, you know, totally treat ADHD with psychological interventions in terms of, you know, making it go away, but we certainly can help these children and adults with certain psychological interventions so that it doesn't have as much of a negative impact. We're talking about strategies such as behavioral management being key, using contingencies both at home and school, using token economies, you know, that they can, you know, earn tokens to get certain kinds of privileges or prizes or tangibles that are desirable to them, to positively reinforce on-task attentive behavior, really trying to speak to their motivation to pay attention. Parent training to help them to deal better or more effectively with these children. For older children and adolescents and adults, teaching them to self-monitor, teaching them to be more aware when they're not being attentive. You know, a lot of times they're not even aware that they're not paying attention. So getting them into a habit of self-monitoring. You know, observing themselves on a regular basis to know when they're not being attentive. Teaching social and organizational skills because we know they have organizational difficulties, and because of their impulsive, hyperactive nature, a lot of times we'll have social difficulties. Psychodynamic and family systems really have not been shown to be that helpful with this particular disorder or these disorders in general, but they could certainly be helpful for any associated symptoms and disorders, you know, such as, you know, if the child with ADHD also is suffering from low self-esteem or depression, etc., etc. Okay, that concludes part one of our lecture on neurodevelopmental disorders. Stay tuned for part two.